Well, everybody, it's great to be with you. Tom Sparrow here in Cincinnati, and today our session is entitled Our Voices, Stories of Diversity, A Pathway to Inclusion in Organizations. And Cheryl Coldfield and Pearl Alexander are our guests. They're diversity experts, and they're at Georgia Institute of Technology, Georgia Tech. And beyond their busy academic world, they present, keynote, train, and coach about storytelling in diversity all over the nation. I wouldn't doubt all over the world. And they're also going to be presenting, I'll just mention, a pre-conference workshop with the Healing Story Alliance, which their session's entitled Bearing Acts, Cultivating Resilience and Wholeness Through Story. So welcome. Thanks for joining our Storytelling and Organization group. Cheryl and Pearl, we're glad to have you here today.
Tom, thank you so much. The pleasure is truly ours. We're delighted to be with you, and I'm always thrilled to have an opportunity to co-present with the esteemed Pearl Alexander. We bring you greetings from sunny Atlanta, where the peaches are very sweet. We're humbled by the invitation to share some of the work we're doing in downtown Atlanta here at Georgia Tech, where we're both responsible for cultural transformation. We work in Institute Diversity here, a unit that reports in to the president. And we were specifically tapped by the executive team to weave storytelling into the very fabric of our campus. So we are actually doing storytelling in our organization. We're excited to be doing storytelling in our organization and really excited by being sanctioned and funded to actually do the work here in our organization, and specifically to be doing it from the platform of where story intersects with diversity and inclusion. Before we go into, I guess, the specifics of the program, Pearl's going to share a bit more about our context here at Georgia Tech.
Yes, Georgia Tech is very diverse. So we have an international presence in both our student body, our faculty and staff. At our main campus sits in the vibrant area called Midtown Atlanta, but we have a global footprint with locations in France, China, Asia, and Latin America. And our academic mission here is to grow leaders that have social courage and intercultural sensitivity such that it will enable them to work across world boundaries and borders. So our focus is very service-oriented and sending students out into the world with this capacity. And the diversity, as you heard, is there. But with diversity comes some degree of tension. And that is where we have to be very strategic in what we do. And it has required us to shift our emphasis and our focus from just that of diversity to inclusion. And we have an aspirational goal at the university for what we call inclusive excellence. So we define diversity as a rich mixture of individuals who bring their differences, their various and multiple identities as individuals. And we look at inclusion as the connection and the experience that individuals have in our environment of being seen and feeling empowered and capable and able of optimizing their contributions. And so we ultimately would say that inclusion perhaps is giving people a sense of belonging. And this is a strategic framework that we have, and so that's another thing that helps us in being able to do our work. We have two broad areas of work in our little team that's changing the world. And one is leadership development, and the other is engagement, employee engagement. In the leadership development area, we have two award-winning programs, and in our engagement space, we are doing multiple things like diversity training, facilitating and overseeing employee resource groups, courageous conversations and dialogues, and now our growing and newest big ticket initiative is the transformative narrative. And so what we're going to do is just give you a little bit of background at this point around our narrative for storytelling and storytelling integration here at Georgia Tech.
So we've been integrating storytelling into the fabric of our campus for a lot of years now, and we'll just share with you a little bit of what we've done over the years leading up to being sanctioned by the executive team to actually do it. In 2012, we started off with some storytelling troops that told stories at our employee resource groups. We have 2,200 members or memberships within our employee resource groups. We started off with a women's storytelling troupe that was called A Woman's World, Lions and Cubs, Our Stories. And it focused on women's challenges, struggles, and triumphs through dramatic monologue and narrative stories. And we also did a program called And Still I Rise, where we gave women the opportunity to create and share their own stories related to living life as a woman. And it was very, very successful. It was always at a grassroots level, though, just something that we were doing as part of the innovative kind of work that we do. The next year at our signature diversity roundtable, we did our first storytelling salon where we're kind of on stage on couches with a complete set. And it was called Unlikely Common Ground, The Importance of Civility and Human Connection in Achieving Inclusive Excellence. And we did storytelling there. We had multiple storytellers, including one national storyteller who came in, and we coupled storytelling with interactive theater and diversity drama. We had over 200 people attending that event, including the president and members of the president's cabinet. And after each story, we would ask very poignant dialogue questions connected to the kind of universal message that might have come out of the story, and that was the beginning of us doing storytelling salons. And that year, there were race stories, gender stories, 9/11 stories, sexual identity stories, all kinds of stories related to diversity dimensions. The next year, we got a little bit more strategic, understanding that sometimes white men, or specifically straight white Christian men, feel like oftentimes that diversity is about everybody but them. And so we decided to focus our annual event on white men and a specific invitation and an extension to white men to join in diversity work. It scratched the surface, you know, of a complex, the complexity of the critical role that white men play in implementing diversity strategy. So we had white men come in and tell stories. We had Chuck Shelton. Some of you might know Chuck. He's the managing director of Great Heart Leadership Lab, and he did the nation's study on white men leading through diversity and inclusion. He came in and did the keynote address, and we had Chris Brazell, who is the director of U.S. Diversity for PricewaterhouseCooper, did a story on lessons learned during his youth when he was forced into cultural friendships on the other side of the track. Our very own dean of students told a class story about how he had hidden his humble beginnings. Even though he kind of looked quote-unquote rich, he was actually covering some humble beginnings. It was a beautiful, beautiful story. Everyone in the audience was crying. We had the retired VP of diversity at Georgia Tech and a partner at one of our premier law firms here in Atlanta. telling stories. One was about being transformed from being an angry, kind of cynical white man, irritated by the concept of diversity, into one with enough empathy and intrigue to write a really breathtaking story about privilege that he performed twice during that time. So that was in 2014. In 2015, there was some expansion around our perception of diversity, and we took diversity in terms of its definition and expanded it completely beyond race, gender, and all of the diversity dimensions that most people think of. And we came to grips with the fact that life experiences are as important to diversity as any of those characteristics. So, for instance, if I'm a black woman and I meet a white man, I might not think we have much in common if I'm focused on just race and gender. But if I were to think about the fact that if we both had alcoholic parents or if we both were introverts or something like that, we started looking for other points of connection where people could connect. And that storytelling event, we brought, again, national storytellers from New York, Chicago, our very own Sue O'Halloran that I think most of you all know, and some other performers came in and talked about their diversity stories. We had a story about like societal expectations around masculinity and stature and the struggles that men have around like male oppression that they can't talk about. Started talking about domestic violence, sexual violence. We had members of our counseling center with us to make sure that if people were triggered, that we would have adequate resources there for them. We were in our first Center for the Arts, which holds about 1,100 people, but we roped it off to have a little over 400 people so it could be a little bit more intimate. But we had members from the community join us for that storytelling event, and believe that people in the community started knowing us for our storytelling probably that year since we had invited so many people in. In 2016, we created diversity or community narratives where we combined story with photography to create portraits. We started that process with a storytelling writing workshop where we asked very, very poignant questions and got people to share stories about their identities and places where people might not be able to see a part of them. And then we brought in a professional photographer, nationally renowned photographer actually from Rhode Island, to try to match photographs to the stories. And then we took the pieces of the stories that we were able to capture a photograph of, and we had artists come in from all over town, particularly at some of our academies focused on art, and to overlay artwork, poetry, writing, drawings onto the pictures. And then we had the museum mounted, so they're framed in beautiful mahogany frames, and there are 24 of them. And they are now both in digital form on our website, as well as we have two versions of a traveling exhibit that is traveling across the campus with people's stories together with their portrait. That was in 2016. And then in 2017 and 18, we created the transformative narratives.
And a little more context for the what we now call Transformative Narrative Initiative. In getting this executive sponsorship, we knew that we were going to have to get some community partners. And so in order to gain momentum, we partnered with some of our faculty leaders who had heard about what we were doing and some who had had the opportunity to participate in some of the events here and there, and we were able to move the idea from the more organic grassroots initiative to a strategic and sanctioned vehicle for transformation. The executive team funded the proposal that was drafted, and we actually referenced the National Storytelling Network and the good work that you all were doing in order to actually convince them that this was a legitimate undertaking and something that would make them proud. And so they said, here you go, here's some seed money, and believing that these portraits or these stories, this initiative of transformative narratives, gathering, collecting stories in multiple ways, would create a practice area to accelerate the shift, the positive shift that we wanted to see towards inclusive behavior and inclusive excellence by telling our stories. And in order for that to happen, some of our justification was also related to competency building and how this storytelling would serve building competency, and particularly around empathy, growing empathy. And we don't have to tell you how story and empathy come together, but what we needed to do organizationally in order to be successful is to start minimizing the lived experiences of people that might be of social isolation, invisibility. Some of these are like impacts of exclusion, you know, feeling minimized, marginalized, what we actually call sometimes emotional abuse at work, you know, when people aren't treated like you care about them or you're not actually allowing them to fully participate. And what we want people to do then is choose civility and to give them some tools for that. And, of course, naturally, story is right up there at the top of the list of things that will do that for us. So we're grateful that was seen, accepted, and gave us a little bit of a budget to actually get some things done. And we are busy about the work of creating a more civil environment in the world we're in today. That's needed more than ever before. And we just think, we just love this notion of the SIO because we're imagining here in our little world that if all organizations across the country and to echo Tom around the world would have something like this going on, just imagine the impact it would have. We would reverse this trend of dehumanizing people and create a more just, connected world. We have three components of our Transformative Narratives Initiative right now. So you heard about our traveling exhibit and the couple of versions of that we have. We're doing live storytelling events. These are things that we have brought with us into this newer world now where we're doing digital things to support our storytelling. And so we're creating a digital library. That's the third component of our work. And these three tenets then are visual story, live story, digital story.
Yeah, and I'll just jump in and share just a little bit more about our live story events. I mentioned the ones that we've been doing since 2012, but this year we created, we think, the nation's first story crawl, which is, I guess, akin to an art crawl. But it was a story crawl where we had seven events planned. We ended up doing six of them because one of the events was going to be around the campfire. It was in February, so it was very cold and raining, so we weren't able to do the campfire event. But we did six events over a two-day period. We had 23 storytellers come in, and they told 56 stories. We had classically trained musicians to come in to play interludes between the stories. So we had a cellist, we had a violinist, we had an acoustic guitar, we had piano players for different ones of the events. They were in our theaters, our black boxes, within classrooms. We did the events around campus where people could crawl from event to event. We also, as part of the digital story library, we are striving to come up with 70 stories for the digital story library over the course of 3 years. We are about a third of the way there now. And one of the things that we've done to collaborate with the faculty and students is we've summoned up music majors, graduate level music majors and minors, and we've had those people to create musical scores and sound designs to go with a number of our stories. And so another one of the live events we had at our acoustic lounge, we had storytelling listening parties where both the storyteller and the music composer came together to offer each other appreciation, have their stories listened to, and got feedback from audiences. So we plan to have more storytelling events like that. That was our first crawl. We'll have another crawl this year coming up. We are also planning on doing a big event around National Coming Out. On that day, we're going to have some storytelling events that day, and we are really, really looking forward to that. With the digital story library, these are stories that are about 6 to 8 minute stories that are on our microsite, and there's a title and keyword so people can search for the kinds of stories that they are. Again, we have added musical scores to a number of them. We've also had our computer people and digital people. We've created a couple of animations for a couple of the stories, and we were recently approached by some people doing work in virtual reality wanting to use some of our stories to do some virtual reality projects. So we're really, really looking forward to those opportunities to do that.
Yes, and as you might imagine, you know, we have the privilege of figuring out how to gather as many stories as we possibly can. And because we're doing this from our diversity and inclusion platform, it's diversity stories that we're after. And so we are supported by a communications campaign. We have a communications manager who is specifically assigned to work with diversity initiatives, and she has a whole host of colleagues over in our Institute Communications Department, and they make us look good. they have helped us to brand the initiative, to create a website with anchor visuals that were designed just for us. They help us with collateral, like creating postcards and videos to help support telling our story and creating this campaign, if you will, to call for stories and for people to know about this initiative in every nook and cranny of the institution. We also have had things like featured breakout sessions at the annual symposiums that are sponsored by the Office of the President and Institute Diversity. We've had campus news stories, social media posts, and just a host of activities that are especially designed to promote this work. And we are also integrating the work by having leaders tell their stories. Part of our leadership development work includes our Inclusive Leaders Academy, where we're teaching leaders about the science of inclusion, and they're able to tell their stories as a part of participation in that initiative, and then we are also broadly welcoming the campus to storytelling workshops that are led by my esteemed colleague, Ms. Cofield, Cheryl Cofield, and she has an entourage that helps her to do this. But it's a very powerful experience, is how it's been described by people who come and participate in the excavation and sharing of their stories.
And so we will pause in a second, but before we do, just want to describe a little bit more about the types of stories that we're gathering. We know that all stories are really, really important and powerful, and that there's all kind of debate about which stories are more important and more whatever, but the stories we're after are diversity stories. Sometimes people think of them as social justice stories, identity stories, stories from exclusion, where a person goes from feeling excluded to feeling included, or stories where a person thought they were practicing inclusion and realized at some point that they themselves were being biased or exclusionary. The diversity story prompts that we use, or I'll just name a few of them. We have a host of them, but the diversity prompts that we use to get people started during our workshops, I'll read a few to you. Hate to read to you, but we don't have a PowerPoint. So one is like a time when, so that people will know that they're looking not necessarily for a general explanation of a topic, but a time when I helped someone overcome prejudice, or I went out of my way to make someone else feel included. I noticed myself prejudging or mistreating a person or group. I thought I knew a person or group and learned that there was much more to their story. I witnessed something related to diversity that made me confused, sad, or angry while growing up. I was silent but wish I had taken a stand for someone else. I wanted to react to a biased comment by a friend or family member. Those are some of them. And then more general prompts, what you can't tell by looking at me, more toward the identity kinds of stories that we talked about. What or who I fight for and why. A recent time I experienced a microaggression and what I did or didn't do. So these are sort of prompts, who my people are, and one stereotype I'd like to dispel about them, a pivotal experience that helped me to see the world differently. We give people prompts to help them along in creating a story that's related to some aspect of their identity, or something that might go toward making us have a more inclusive environment, more toward transforming the culture to an inclusive environment. We, in addition to the diversity stories, we also focus on stories that bring out people's diversity challenges. Roosevelt Thomas, who was one of the fathers of diversity work, created a concept called strategic diversity management, where he defined diversity as a mix of differences and similarities, and really emphasized that the natural tension that flows from diversity is just there, and we don't need to pretend that it's not there, that there is a natural tension that comes when people are mixed in with people who are not like them. We are naturally more comfortable with people who are like us. And in our journey along a diversity spectrum, when we're in that kind of mix, like we are here at Georgia Tech, represented by over 100 different countries, when we're in this kind of mix, it's going to be uncomfortable. And people might go from being diversity challenged, where they don't really know how to deal with the diversity, and they're really up against a lot of their biases, prejudices, generalizations, or whatever, to becoming diversity capable, where despite that discomfort, they're still able to act in fair and just ways, to becoming actually diversity mature, which is one of our aspirational goals here at Georgia Tech, to help our leaders become, you know, very agile and to have a lot of cultural dexterity. We want them to be diversity mature, But what Roosevelt said was that the first thing you have to do in order to become diversity mature is to recognize and acknowledge where your diversity challenged. So to pretend, oh my God, I'm colorblind, and you know, all of the things that we pretend that we are not diversity challenged, there's no way to get diversity mature until you acknowledge that you're diversity challenged. So we do a lot of work around helping people understand more about where they are challenged and biased.
Yes, and this is a very sensitive excavation, as you might imagine. And so we work with them to get to that place, that vulnerable place, where they can actually share. You know, we have them explore the shadow just as much as the virtue around who they are and what their diversity journeys have been. And we coach them in sharing. And one of the things that we first have to orient them to is, what does it mean to be biased? And that's simply just having preferences or a predisposition, an inclination towards something. And as we like to say, that if you have a brain, you are biased. You know, people say, are we biased? Mm-hmm. Of course we're biased. You know, it's simply the way we're wired. Our brains are these magnificent operating systems. It's not about being a good person and a bad person, so we take it out of that context and help people to understand the neuroscience of bias, and that our brains have this huge capability to manage large quantities of data. I read something somewhere that we process something like 11 million pieces of data at any one point in time in a day. And we're making decisions every day, and our brains are wired to help us know whether we're safe or not, what's appropriate, and all of that. We're magnificently made. And so they have these what we call danger detectors, you know, and just like the sensors on the vehicle. You know, if something dangerous is coming or getting too close, it starts beeping. It's the same thing that happens with you and your brain, you know. Danger alert. And so we make choices then. We react. And these are what we call the unconscious, hidden choices that we make. And sometimes we have to step back and be able to notice what are our regular perceptions of ourselves and others and what's underneath that. And so we talk about similarity bias, which is that in-group, out-group bias, quite a bit. And as Cheryl mentioned, that's just where we feel more comfortable with people who we feel are like us. In-group is good, out-group is bad. In-group is safe, out-group is not. In-group is superior, out-group is not. You know, we have that affinity. And so when we do more of the excavation, we provide the story stems that Cheryl mentioned, and then we have people take a shot at sharing an experience. We say it doesn't have to be perfect, you know, but just reach for it. And so I'm going to ask Cheryl to model for you, because that's typically how we do before we let them share. We model.
Hello. So I'll model just quickly like a diversity challenge, because a lot of people are not so ready to want to talk about places where they're diversity challenged. There are customer service calls I occasionally make to places like Verizon Wireless or American Express. I usually dial the number, quietly praying that a familiar voice, yes, that's it, a familiar voice picks up. That's the nice way of saying I'm sitting there hoping with everything inside of me that the person who picks up the phone does not have a thick accent. Sometimes I hold my breath, waiting to see if the person has an accent. I convince myself that none of this is personal. that I'm not being any particular kind of way toward any particular group. I'm just trying to be efficient with my time and to communicate well. I convince myself that I never stereotype or make judgments about whether people have accents or whether people who have accents should have customer service jobs. I convince myself that my thoughts and motives are pure and good, since after all, I am a seasoned diversity professional. And then I notice myself from a distance, and from a distance I notice myself, and I see myself speaking to the person with the accent, and I notice that I'm actually a bit smug, as if I'm superior, and almost as if to say, this is my country, and you need to speak English in this country. And as I notice myself speaking to the person with the accent, I notice that I sometimes sound a bit irritated, even condescending, and that if things don't go my way, I may just throw my hair back and say, please connect me to your supervisor. No one has ever witnessed me act this way, but I am completely honest with you today, and I'm being honest with myself and confessing that this thing happens all the time. Another one. It was January 2003, and I was looking to hire a deputy director for a diversity program. I was standing up. I could not have been more pleased when the recruiting department cheerfully forwarded a 7-page resume bursting at the seams with excellence. Dr. Ann Faith Harris had advanced degrees, had written an intriguing dissertation about diversity, and had already successfully done most things I only dreamed of doing. During our phone interview, her voice, vocabulary, and command of diversity principles made my heart skip a beat, and I was thrilled to learn that she wanted to relocate to Atlanta to pursue her dream of becoming a jazz singer. She was in, as far as I was concerned, but it seemed mature to create a little selection panel and fly her in just to make sure we dotted all the I's and crossed the T's. 2 weeks later, Dr. Ann Harris strolled into my office in free-flowing, multicolored, Afrocentric attire with long brown dreadlocks flowing down her back. Now, I had worn my best tailored navy blue Jones of New York suit with crisp white blouse and pearl earrings. After nervously greeting her, I sat down at my desk, and poof, in less than an instant, I had forgotten everything I thought I knew about Dr. Ann Harris. I picked up my fancy pen and smiled and began the interview. Her answers were mature, thoughtful, measured, and brilliant. I engaged her in a way that allowed her to believe she was still a viable candidate. At the conclusion of the interview, I politely excused the selection committee and said we'd debrief the next day. That night seemed like the longest night in my life. I tossed and turned and struggled and wrestled and fought with myself. I looked around my home and noticed Egyptian batiks, Nigerian sculptures, South Kenyan masks, Ethiopian lithographs, soapstone and ivory collections. I had created a home to ensure my family remembered who we were and where we came from. Despite the drumbeat of Dear Africa in my soul, I convinced myself that unfortunately, Dr. Ann Harris had used poor judgment coming to my interview looking like that. I convinced myself that despite her brilliance and stellar credentials, I could hardly afford to take a chance on my second in charge having poor judgment, especially given the political nature of the work and the need to fit into that political environment. That was it. I'd announced the next morning that she quite simply was not a culture fit. Culture fit, that was it, brilliant. I guess it was the ancestors that came in the middle of the night to restore me to my senses. I hired Dr. Ann Faith Harris in January of 2003, and she proved to be the best employee I had ever had. She taught me more than I could ever teach her, protected me from others as well as myself, and pushed me to greater heights than I could have ever imagined. Ann Faith continues to run an outstanding diversity program in the heart of downtown Atlanta and just released her freshman CD last year. We continue to be great friends, often traveling together, sometimes drinking wine and listening to the sweet sounds of African drums. So those are just kind of ways that we give people permission to tell the truth maybe about ways that they may or may not be diversity challenged. It takes a lot of courage to do. Pearl, did you have a...
Okay, yeah, I kind of wanted you to just sit with that for just a few seconds because we'd love for you to think for just a couple of minutes about your diversity journey and maybe take a note or two for yourself about where you might need to do your work as executive coaches and story coaches, leadership coaches. You know, we've always got to ask that question, where do you need to do your work? What's a personal story that you have? You know, are you diversity challenged? And where are you diversity challenged? What stories might you be making up about people? And what emotions come along with those? These are all things that we explore in the workshop and invite people further into their experiences. That way we have them connect with the emotions of them and then have them share around a circle. We usually do these in a circle, a very intimate circle. And so I hope you've taken a moment to actually take a note or two. And we're going to maybe take another 10 seconds, 15 seconds for you to do that. And then we'll pick up again in a moment.
Tom, I want to do a quick time check. Is 4:45 our time to stop or our time to transition into Q&A, or exactly what is 4:45?
I like to try to keep our phone calls to about 45 minutes, and that's from when we started recording. So we have 5, maybe 10 minutes right now to finish out the phone call, and I'd like to check in with people to see what questions we have. And, of course, if you guys have other material you wanted to cover, we can hit that as well.
The only other thing that we wanted to cover was to just say that these are not easy stories to get from people because there are some common fears that come up and common feelings. People feel embarrassed and ashamed and sad and like they might be misunderstood and defensive and untrustworthy. There are common feelings that come up when engaging in discussions around identity, privilege, discrimination, or anything like that. And they are also perfectly logical explanations that block people from being able to talk about these things. There are things people say like, this happened to me in my group too. I know someone else who did this, so I don't agree with you. There are just different ways that it's very difficult. People believe that they might make a mistake in telling these kinds of stories. They don't want to say anything that's stereotypical or biased. They don't want to hurt the relationship or be seen as less than a friend or make matters worse. There are just so many fears that people have around even talking about this kind of stuff or telling these kinds of stories. And then finally, another thing is people want to assert, I have a clean heart and mind, that I'm not biased. But as Pearl said, if we have brains, we're biased. I mean, it's like we are biased, and the only way to get past it sometimes is to have the conversation. So a lot of times we help people along past both color blindness. You know, just like unless you were physiologically diagnosed with color blindness, more than likely you're not colorblind, so it's not useful to say I don't even see you as A, B, and C. And then the whole thing around transcendence, that I was raised better than that and my values are A, B, and C. A lot of times it hinders the real authentic conversation about these things. So there are obstacles to getting these kinds of stories that we just wanted to mention. And so we'll stop there and see if there are any questions or any questions that we can answer for you.
Hi, this is Bill White. I have a question.
Okay, Bill.
So as I was listening to your stories, I was struck by, I guess, I recall Brené Brown's advice to be curious about our own response to things, to sort of take that observer position, and I saw that reflected in some of your stories. And I've been trying to figure out how to frame this question because it made me want to ask you about the overlap between the Rising Skills Dialogue and the work that you're going to be doing at the NSN conference and this diversity work. But there's so much overlap, I think I want to flip the question around and ask you if you find yourself doing anything in diversity work that doesn't include this sort of courage and vulnerability, and conversely, if you see things you're doing in the Daring Way, Rising Skills type work that doesn't apply to diversity, because the overlap seems so great.
Bill, thank you for such a brilliant observation. I think we started out sharing that the reason we were asked to come and be a part of this Institute diversity team was just that. We don't necessarily think in terms of traditional diversity and inclusion work, and we absolutely just loved Brené's materials and the research that she has, and that's why we wanted to become certified in it, because we saw the nexus between what she had researched and allowed us to bring some different kind of research to the work of diversity and inclusion at Georgia Tech. And so it was a strategic move for us to actually move in that direction, and so brilliant of you. I think you're the first person who's ever put it together like that.
Yeah, but I don't think that we can do one without the other. All of this work takes courage, and a lot of times actually talking about it in a truthful way brings up shame, and you have to be vulnerable, like when you get to the door of shame. So it's all overlapping. It's a great question.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, it's Julian. I was a recruiter for many, many, many years, and it was a good thing my phone was on mute, because that was the most compelling, honest, brave, crazy brave overview of the thought process that happens in an interview from your standpoint, and I think that takes so much courage. And, I mean, I just was impressed because all the internal workings were there, right, laid out for everybody. So I'm just sitting here with my mouth open going, holy Christmas. So thank you for mute button.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
This is Tricia, and I would just echo what Julie said. I was enthralled by the stories, and not just enthralled, but deeply moved and touched, and reflective, you know, and like all the best stories, it made me think about my own behavior, and the honesty with which these stories were relayed is just compelling. So, I don't have a question. I just wanted to make that comment. So thank you both very much.
Thank you. We're holding out hope, and we're holding out hope that you all will reach for your own stories, because it's very healing for me. Even when I pick up the phone and someone with an accent answers now, there are some things that I still am fighting against in order to just do better in those phone calls. So it helps to be able to acknowledge it and expose it to the sunlight, because I know that I have to do better when I expose it.
So Tom joining in here, and I too, Cheryl, just love the fact that you shared your personal stories, and they are very moving. And I find it so compelling. You know, this is why I'm interested in this, is because I listen to all the things that you're doing, and there's just an amazing array of things. And I took lots of notes, and it's just all very interesting. But then when you get down to actually sharing your story, just the little modeling that you did, it just, that stands out. It's so powerful. And I just really appreciate Pearl setting it up and you sharing your stories. I do have a question attached to that. You know, you said that it's very difficult. What are some of the kind of coaching techniques that you two use to help people open up to get to that vulnerability and to work through the shame?
Yeah, I think that we're both sort of, and I'll speak for both of us, and Pearl can correct me if I'm wrong. I think in terms of our natural gifts, I think that we are both naturally gifted in creating safety. That's kind of the unspoken thing that we are both able to do that we didn't go to school for and didn't get certification in, but that emanates from inside of us. So I think oftentimes it's through the vulnerability and the courage that people see in us and the non-judgment that they see in us that they are able to be, and we welcome emotion into the room, and we welcome vulnerability. That's overarching what I can say. Pearl?
I think you hit it on the head. I don't want to, belabor things, but I do feel like that that creating psychological safety is important to all of our work, and, that what's huge in that is being able to share and model vulnerability, as well as create a space of non-judgment. And a lot of times that also requires you to ask a very powerful question at the right time and in the right moment. So you have to be feeling with a person and recognizing when you see emotion that hasn't actually erupted. And there are some other interesting techniques. We ask, sometimes it's just as simple as what happened.
Mm-hmm.
We're recovering human resources professionals. And so we're much more curious than we are investigative in our questioning. But, just sometimes that one little thing of what happened, and then what happened was a technique that we also learned.
Would it be possible for you two to send me the list of prompts that you went through, and then I could post it for our group?
Yeah, Tom, right now we are being here at an academic institution just in terms of intellectual property. We are not able to do that right now. We probably would not be able to send those. I guess they are on the recording. some of them come from some of our consultants. We've consolidated and not actually talk with them about sharing a document that includes them. So, and working for Georgia Tech, there's a lot of times intellectual property issues around sharing things.
Sure, that makes perfect sense, and that's why they're probably so good.
Oh, Tom. Yeah.
Well, I think we're going to have to call it an afternoon, but what a great call and what interesting work that you're doing. I know this is very valuable for our members to think about all the different ways that we can bring in diversity and help people to feel included as well. So thank you very much, Cheryl Colefield and Pearl Alexander. It was a great call.
All right.
We really
appreciate
it.
Thank you.
Thank you
for having us.
Thank you so much. Bye now.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. And Jules, stay on the line and any of our other board members. Thanks.